For the week of June 17th, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 413, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in I'm not in New York. And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz. Welcome back from Europe, Sperling.
Well, thank you very much. I'm back from the continent.
Yes, you are. The news never stops. The second we finish recording our show about the, and we do a rundown of all the upcoming Broadway shows, they add two more.
Wait, what?
The second we're done saying, oh, what do you think of this show hitting Broadway in the fall? What do you think of that show? We hang up the phone and two new shows are announced. One stars Kerry Washington and the other stars Daniel Radcliffe as a fact checker, a news magazine fact checker. My old job. I'm going to be cool again. So there's There's always things happening. So, you know, the second you're gone, the news piles up. We got a lot to cover. What are we going to talk about this week?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we discover that absence makes the heart grow fonder. Oh, that's very kind of you, because I was absent last week, and then, of course, you're fonder of... Oh, I think you might be talking about the animated film franchise The Incredibles, actually, because that took 14 years to deliver a sequel, but audiences showed up at theaters in droves. And I took off a week, as I just mentioned, while working in Europe, but our listeners are ready and waiting for a new episode. In Japan, people are less patient. That country's film Shoplifters was one of the big winners at the Cannes Film Festival, as we explained, and it leaped to a domestic release weeks later that looks set to be a major hit. In China, a dispute over whether actors are paid too much turned into a government investigation of tax evasion, and the censorship of movies and TV shows has grown only stronger. In theater, we follow up the Tony Awards to applaud its big winner, The Band's Visit, celebrate the success of indie producers on a great white way dominated more and more by corporations, and poo-poo the idea that winning the Tony for Best Musical isn't a boost at the box office. During Sexual Misconduct, we observe the continuing fall of John Lasseter, the finger-pointing at Chris Hardwick, and the redemption of actor George Takei. On Inside Baseball, we'll of course talk about the AT&T takeover of Time Warner, or should we say Warner Media, and what that means for a rapidly changing media landscape. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, you, our listeners. And if you wanted to be on the charts this week, if you wanted to be one of the 25 highest grossing films in the entire world, you had to gross about $900,000. That's where Sherlock Gnomes is at number 25. That animated film has made about $86 million and counting. If you wanted to make the top 10, you had to gross about $6 million. That's where Superfly is, the remake of the blaxploitation classic. That opened up a few days early. That's made about $8.4 million worldwide. And if you wanted to be the number one movie in the world, you'd have to be pretty incredible. That's right. The Incredibles 2 grossed $231 million worldwide. The biggest opening of all time for an animated film.
Yes, and that is actually, you know, I know we always talk about adjusting for inflation. In this case, it doesn't matter.
It also includes adjusting for taking out those Thursday numbers. You don't want to compare a four-day gross to a film's three-day gross. So even when you pull out the Thursday night numbers for Incredibles, they grossed $18.5 million on a Thursday. Finding Dory, for example, was the previous record holder without adjusting for them. That grossed $9 million on a Thursday. But even if you pull those numbers out, Friday to Sunday, Incredibles 2 is the bigger winner. Even if you adjust for inflation, you look back at Shrek the Third, I think it was. Was that the one you were looking at?
Yes.
The record before that adjusted for inflation. Even then, The Incredibles 2 triumphed. So it made a lot of money. Boy, they took a long time to make this sequel. But I saw it. It was fun. I didn't think it was great, nearly as good as the first one. But I liked it, enjoyed it. I like it a little better in retrospect. You know, as I think about it a little bit more, I sort of liked it. I liked the film, and I felt it was solid. Certainly audiences loved it. It was jam-packed where I was in Birmingham, Alabama. I don't know if that was because of Movie Pass on a Thursday night, but clearly people showed up. They were ready to see it. and it's raking in the bucks.
I will say this, you know, I tried to see the film with MoviePass over the weekend, and part of the problem, of course, is you can't buy a ticket in advance, right?
You can't. You can go that morning. You can swing by the theater. I've done that.
Right, exactly. That's really the only way to do it. But of course, by then, you know, on Father's Day, I was trying to go see it. That was really tough to get a good seat in the theater. You know, I could sit on top of the screen. I could do that. But, you know, sitting anywhere in the center of the theater, forget about it.
I went Thursday night at an 8 p.m. or 9 p.m. screening. The theater was full, but I was only looking for a single ticket. I walked up literally as the trailers were beginning and bought a ticket and had no problem. You know, so it was full, but you could do it.
Well, you know, speaking of MoviePass, I know we don't have any MoviePass news this week, but they did actually announce they had surpassed 3 million subscribers. And I do plan on seeing American Animals this week. That is the film that they picked up at Sundance with The Orchard, a small independent distributor. They're co-distributing it, and it's playing at a theater near me, and I do plan on using MoviePass to go see their movie.
Well, they had less success with Gotti. That's another film MoviePass has plunked some money down on. Again, that doesn't seem like a smart use of very limited funds, but that John Travolta biopic, which is bizarrely a loving ode to the mobster John Gotti. Apparently, it just thinks he's the cat's meow. That's a little crazy. Terrible reviews, not doing well. It opened up at $1.6 million in North America. But going back to the top of the charts, The Incredibles is at number one with $230 million worldwide. At number two is Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. It's doing great in the Middle Kingdom, where it's been a big, big hit. Hasn't opened up yet in North America, but over the weekend it grossed $173 million. It's at $370 million worldwide. So that clearly is going to be another big $800, $900 billion movie. And we take that as like, oh yeah, that's going to make $1 billion. That's a lot of money. Only a handful of films in history have made $1 billion. And this movie cost $170 million to make. That's going to be a lot of profit.
Well, now, this movie has already opened, as you mentioned, in China. It's also opened up in Europe. Why is that?
Well, you wanted to get in there before World Cup, of course.
Okay, there you go. Yes, that is true. Now, in Poland, and this was a bit of a talk of Cine Europe, apparently Cold War, the film by Paweł Pawlowski, it's a black and white film, period piece. It was in Cannes and did incredibly well in Cannes. It was a good film. It beat out Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom in its opening weekend.
On per screen or total gross?
Total gross, yeah.
Very, very cool. Well, maybe there's hope for those people. They can overthrow their right-wing government. That's very interesting. Wow, that's not a film you would expect to beat out a blockbuster by any country anytime. So that's pretty cool. At number three around the world is Ocean's 8, another franchise flick. $38 million on the weekend, $117 million worldwide. And at number four is Deadpool 2, the Marvel Comics action film from Fox. $18 million on the weekend. That's going to hit $700 million worldwide in just a minute. Look at the top four films. Sequel, 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 sequel. Or I guess remake in the case of Ocean's 8. Reboot. Sequel, sequel, reboot, sequel. So, you know, the idea that people are sick of sequels, sick of all that stuff. No. If you make a movie and people enjoy it, they will go. There have been sequels and remakes and reboots since the beginning of cinema, since the beginning of storytelling. You know, we'd like to see fresh original content all the time, but, you know, sequels and franchises are just part of what Hollywood and TV does. They always have. They always will. Make it well, and you can make money. So you can't just point at a movie and say, oh, that's a sequel. That's why it did poorly. Or, oh, that's a sequel. That's why it did great. It's the individual movie that matters.
Well, I can't remember who said it at Cine Europe, but it was on one of the panels on the first day. And, you know, there were folks like Stacey Snyder, Mookie Greidinger, Mookie being the head of Cineworld, which is now one of the largest movie theater chains in the world. Stacey Snyder being the head of Fox, at least for now. I can't remember who said it, that, you know, the movie business is a prototype business, that every time you release a film, it's brand new. And so any chance you have to reduce the risk on that prototype is you're going to take it. Well, of course, you get Deadpool 2 when that happens.
Well, and it makes money.
Right. And what about Tag?
Tag is an original film based on a magazine article, and it sounds a little fresh, a little silly. It's about a group of men who have been playing tag once a month a year for like decades. They're adult men. And in like, I forget, July or August or something, they play tag and they go to crazy extremes, tagging each other when their wife is giving birth, things like that. So it's silly, fun, but with male bonding, it grossed $16 million on its opening weekend. It only cost $30 million to make, so it'll probably be okay, but not great reviews or great box office, but it did all right. And it's a modest roll of the dice. It's what you should do for a modest proposal like that. Very differently is Solo, A Star Wars Story. That's at number six. That grossed another $14 million over the weekend. That's at $340 million worldwide. It still has yet to open up in Japan. I believe that's the last major territory waiting for Solo. But clearly, this movie is not going to even hit $500 million. It's not going to hit $500 million. And when it cost $250 million to make, that's a rough estimate. Boy, that has collapsed like very few films we've seen in a while. At number seven is Hereditary, the horror film starring Toni Collette. I'm going to go see it because I've heard interesting things about it. It grossed another $12 million on the weekend. It's about to hit $40 million worldwide. At number eight is a film, and I know nothing about it, A Strong Insect Crossing the River.
That sounds to me like a film that is probably an international film, not from North America.
We know it's not North American. We know it sounds, I don't know, but it grossed $9.8 million on the weekend. I did everything I could to try to figure out what it was, but no luck.
Even in China?
I got lots of pictures of bugs. You know, when I tried to Google that, I tried to look up the trailer, their mating habits, lovely photos. That's all I got.
That's very, very funny.
So if you know what A Strong Insect Crossing the River is, where it opened, that's a lot of money, $9.8 million. Contact us.
Yes, you can. it's true. When you Google the film title, you get a lot of pictures of bugs. But if you do know about the film, please do write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle, or, you know, like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. And I know that's how Greg Bridle often writes into us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And I ran into him at Cine Europe, and he says he still listens to the show regularly.
That's awesome. Thanks, Greg, for listening in and offering in comments. We don't always mention the comments that people send to us because sometimes a lot of people send it at once or we had it already, but we always appreciate it. Makes us know we're on the right track. And number nine around the world is
Wait a second. This just in. Okay. Now, this is A Strong Insect Crossing the River. Beats is a comedy film produced by Jingyi Film Company, LTD, directed by... Oh, I cannot pronounce these.
Don't try. Just tell us what country is the film in.
Taiwan.
Ah.
And The Northern Tigers uses young Shen Yang and Pan Bin Long as Northeastern youths to go to Taiwan to seek pro-main lines, and describes the process of the two men punishing evil and building up their merits.
Well, if they gross $9 million on opening weekend in Thailand, that's a heck of a big opening.
No, not
right?
Not Thailand, Taiwan.
Oh, Taiwan. That's a very strong opening for that market.
It's considered a Chinese comedy, action comedy.
I'm sure, but they opened up. Did they open up in China or just in Taiwan? We don't know.
It looks like they opened territory. Up in China.
Really? So they didn't open up in Taiwan?
Well,
that's surely a separate film market.
I remember, you know, they consider it one China.
No, China does, not Taiwan. They don't. They don't consider it one country.
Well,
they consider themselves an independent country. They're not asking China what they think. They're saying, we're our own country. You can look that up. Find out for us. Is Taiwan a separate film market? Or is it, if you open up in Taiwan, is it considered the same, you know, would it be one territory or two? It's listed as opening up in one territory. We assume now it's open in China because it's $9.8 million. That's a lot of money. So, but if it opened up in Taiwan as well, would that be territory number two? Find out for this. That's your homework. And is that a drama or a comedy?
It's an action comedy.
Action comedy. All right. Well, this just in. Thank you for that breaking news. I don't know why I failed. I tried. I did everything I could. I don't know. All right. Anyway, number nine is The Avengers Infinity Wars. Disney's doing something wrong with Han Solo, but they're doing something right with The Avengers. $8 million on the weekend, $2 billion $20 million, over $2 billion for Avengers Infinity War. Right below that is Superfly, another, again, the entire, you know, list is filled with remakes, reboots, and all that sort of stuff. Superfly didn't do that great. It made about $8 million on its opening weekend. The Accidental Detective 2 is a Korean crime comedy. You could even call it an action crime comedy. $6 million on its opening weekend. At number 12 is an Indian sequel, Race 3. It's a crime thriller about drug lords, and they released it timed to the end of Ramadan because nothing says family time after Ramadan like seeing a film about drug lords. But that movie opened up to $4.8 million. People were ready for some entertainment after a month of fasting and celebration. At number 13, Book Club picked up some more money, $66 million worldwide. At number 14, Adrift, the, what's her name, Shailene Woodley?
Yes, Shailene Woodley.
Yes. Not doing great with this film. She's headlining this movie, made just under $30 million worldwide so far. And number 15 is the Chinese time-traveling romantic drama, How Long Will I Love You? $136 million worldwide. That's at number 15. Scrolling down to for some new movies, we have The Seventh Dwarf. This is sort of interesting. It's a German animated film. It's a sequel to two live-action films in the same franchise. So this one is animated. The earlier two were live-action. The same actors do the voices for their characters, by and large. The last one came out about a decade ago, and the first one was one of the biggest German hits of all time. So this movie is chugging along. It's made $21 million. From the looks of the trailers and the pictures, it looks like it's a pretty inexpensive animated film. So that looks like a very profitable budget.
Well, and it made $1.2 million over, that's actually, is it daily box office? It might be the weekend box office in mm-hmm. China. Okay.
Oh. It opened up in the Middle Kingdom.
Yes. It's made $3.1 million there to date. You know, that how long will I love you, by the way? $136 million so far. That's pretty remarkable.
That is a lot of money.
And by the way, going back to our bug movie, our insect movie, okay? Mm-hmm. It did open in China, and it is called The Way of the Bug.
Oh, so ComScore had a slightly different title, and that threw a wrench into the works for me.
Yes.
That's, you know, of course, it's in Taiwanese, so it's not called that. It's called whatever it is in Taiwanese, and now we're trying to translate it into English. So different people will have different translations.
Right.
So we don't know if they were wrong, but it didn't help us in figuring out what the movie was.
Correct.
And scrolling down a couple movies, Jodie Foster has a new movie out in North. Well, no, it's been out for a little bit, I guess. It's made $10 million. Hotel Artemis, a dystopian drama. Not tearing it up exactly. Made about $900,000 over the weekend. But at some points, kindness and decency prevail. Won't You Be My Neighbor? The documentary film about Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, is doing just great in North America. It's in 96 screens. It's ranked number 14. It's grossed $1.7 million. That is already a lot of money for a documentary film. I can't wait for this movie to open wide. I bet you it hits the top 10. Two documentaries hitting the top 10 at any time of the year, you know, right after each other. That's pretty amazing. RBG did it, the Ruth Bader Ginsburg documentary, and now Mr. Rogers. It really is a sweet and fascinating movie. If you have a chance to see it, I say check it out.
Well, now I know I've been stuck on China. That's because I actually pulled up the Chinese grosses. Okay, so that might be why. However, you know, they're making all this money in China. And of course, as just happened in the US and North America, some of that money trickles down. You know where it goes to? Some of the people that make movies. And, you know, in Hollywood, fans are proud of how much movie stars get paid. You know, $20 million for Tom Cruise or Will Smith, $30 million for Robert Downey Jr. as Iron Man. It's kind of cool, right?
Fans are proud?
I don't know if they're
like,
proud.
Yeah, he has more money than me.
Well, in China, big salaries are a touchy topic. So a TV presenter, get this, raised a row when suggesting one of China's biggest movie stars was overpaid and that it's actually hurting the industry. And Kui Yong Yuan is one of the biggest TV stars around, a talk show host with an affable low-key charm that has since been imitated by countless others. It's kind of funny that, you know, China being known for copying intellectual property, they're now copying each other. Yong Yuan has been a star for 20 years and is good at stoking controversy, such as a takedown of the GMO food filled with pseudoscience, anti-corruption pieces, and more. Now, he said, this is a name that we all know, Fan Bingbing.
She's a big Chinese star. And a couple weeks ago now, we're catching up with this story, so it's taken a couple turns. He basically said she makes too much money. And then he doubled down by releasing her contract online, showing people what she was making and the riders in her contract. And it was like $1 million plus for 4 days' work. And people were shocked and upset for various social reasons that you discussed, how it's a little touchier topic. And the writer sounded absurd. Two limos, not one, at her beck and call. Things like this. Hollywood people were like, that looks perfectly reasonable to me. But it created a big row in China. She was upset. The people were angry. Was this, you know, did he break some confidence? Should he do this? Then a day or two later, he released another contract saying, hey, look, she's got a second contract. And this is what they do so they can pay you, but you can write it off to another business and not have to pay taxes on it. Basically accusing her of tax evasion and showing actually she made like $10 million for 4 days' work. Even bigger row. Later turns out he said, well, actually that second contract was not about her personally necessarily. And I don't know anything about her taxes, but she still makes too much money. Now the government is investigating because there are a lot of times where people get two contracts. Maybe for their independent shell company. People don't usually get paid directly, even when they're a movie star. You don't pay Tom Cruise. You probably pay an LLC he set up either permanently or for that particular movie. And this is all for complicated tax purposes. So it's not unusual to pay a separate company. They don't even work for you.
Well,
so
that's true here. It's called a loan out company in
exactly. Exactly. So it is true that a high pay is a touchy subject in China. It is true that he showed a second contract, but then he backtracked and said, well, I don't think that really has anything to do with her. She says, I am not overpaid. I love my people. I am not evading taxes. Government agencies are, however, looking into it and thinking, is this a bigger problem than we thought? We really should be looking at this, to the point where investigations have been launched. The stock prices of numerous major film and TV companies fell on the earnings of that day or two when those investigations were announced. And people are saying, no. And the clever thing is that China Film Insider called it movie stars, China movie stars, and the two contract problem, which is a play on a sci-fi film by one of the best science fiction writers around, a Chinese author called the three body problem. So I thought that was really clever. But it's a problem. It's an issue. He roiled a lot of feathers by printing her contract. That's really, you know, untoward. You know, you can criticize people's salary without, you know, exposing their contract to scrutiny. But we're going to see where it ends up, but he's retracted a little bit. She has denounced it and said, I'm a lovely person, and the government is looking into it.
Well, and here's a little something to kind of put in your back pocket. So to stoke some investment in a specific area in China, Wuxi specifically, and Wuxi is in China's Jiangsu province, the State Administration of Taxation has, kind of lowered the taxes there and said, you know, if you right. invest money and you open companies and so what they wound up doing, all of these media companies, is you kind of place your company there. That way, you know, the money that's made is taxed at a different rate and taxed lower.
That's why Showbiz Sandbox pays me via my company in Bermuda.
Correct. The check is in the mail. And so, you know, so her company is located there. And so that's one of the things that, and by the way, lots of media companies are located there. So, of course, a lot of, as you mentioned, Michael, a lot of media companies are now going, uh-oh.
And in truth, my LLC for my website is located in Delaware because they do that a lot and they have a lower tax rate. And that's a business that they, you know, cultivate.
Correct.
That's why European companies are based in Ireland. They offer a lower tax rate. They offer this, that, and the other thing. So it happens a lot. That's not unusual. If you think they shouldn't have those special zones, that's a perfectly valid argument. Make that argument. But there's nothing wrong with having your thing placed there if it's there. You shouldn't avoid paying taxes, however. However, now is the point where I'd like to say we should be taking Cantonese and Mandarin lessons, shouldn't we? We really need to go to class. We deal with these words all the time, the language. I think we need to brush up.
Well, we certainly, we butcher them on a regular basis. So we are either, you know, butchers of language or we need to...
We're running dog barbarians for sure. Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. But, you know, China remains in the news. Some points being made by an internal memo that was covered on a website, supchina.com, points to increasing restrictions on TV and movies. They released an internal memo that was sent out by the government, sent to different TV and movie people, encouraging you on self-censorship, talking about the things you should avoid, things you should emphasize. You know, if you can do a coming-of-age story, You should really avoid romance, crime, and violence, which means, I guess, avoid coming-of-age stories. I mean, if there's no romance, you know, what the heck? Crime stories need to get approved by the government. Don't include too many details about the crime. Celebrities who have been scandalized shouldn't be featured in movies or TV shows. Don't promote weapons or wars, blah, blah, blah. There's just all sorts of rules and regulations, and they are getting a little tighter right now. So, you know, we'll have to see where that ends up. But you're doing business in China. It's never easy, and sometimes it gets harder.
Well, I wonder how Ocean's 8 would play in China. You know, you'd have the opening scene and then that scene at the end. I mean, that's pretty much all you got.
That's right. That's based on a movie. And of course, a lot of movies are based on books.
Oh,
and if we look at box office, if we look at the book box office, there is some good news there. North American sales were up in April compared to 1 year earlier. That's according to the publishing industry and reporting on sales reported from publishers to them. Book sales are up in North America compared to 1 year earlier. So that's another glimmer of positive good news.
Well, it was good news for the band's visit at the Tony Awards, which I know at this point is like a week ago. Okay, so I know we're behind, but since we didn't have a show.
News.
Yeah, well, I will say this. While we were away, Robert De Niro did say the F word. Actually, he said it twice. And weirdly, that made headlines. And it seems to me like he's always saying the F word, but usually exactly. In a Martin Scorsese movie. Now, it happened at the Tonys, where the real news was, as I just mentioned, a historical sweep by the band's visit, which snagged a massive, get this, 10 Tony Awards, including Best Musical. So here's my question. Did the critics win? Was Broadway rejecting the tourist attraction appeal of shows like SpongeBob and Frozen and Mean Girls and the next title that I'm about to announce, which is probably based on a movie? Now, it's hard to argue when the best play winner, by the way, was Harry Potter. Okay, so but various articles did insist that winning the Tony for Best Musical is not, I repeat, not a recipe for success. Sometimes the shows that lose run longer. And as one study pointed out, of the last 10 Best Musical winners, only 4 are still running. 6 have closed. So,
all right. So, yeah. So, you know, I wanted to talk about the Tonys, and something I hadn't realized, which somebody pointed out, was that the big news here is the triumph of independent producers, as opposed to, say, Disney and Universal and the big machines that are on Broadway. You need a big range of shows. That's great. But when you look at the Tony winners for the last decade, most of them have been for scrappy shows financed by independent producers, shows like The Band's Visit and Once. And shows like that, not the big behemoths. So that is really cool. I hadn't recognized that as such. So that's a great thing to see. You look at the last 10 years, you have the winners are In the Heights, the Lin-Manuel Miranda, which was a big roll of the dice. Billy Elliot, the musical, that had big backing. Memphis, The Book of Mormon, Once, Kinky Boots, A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, Fun Home, Hamilton, Dear Evan Hansen, and The Band's Visit. Of all of them, 1, 2, 3 are original and not based on anything else in the world. All the 7 others are based on a book, a movie, a graphic novel, a previous film from decades past. They're all based on something else. So that's sort of interesting to note. But a lot of these are fresh and well-reviewed and great big hits, and everybody's happy with them. But so as someone said, yeah, you know what? The indie producer is still triumphing, at least artistically, because they're winning the Tony for Best Musical. That's cool to see.
Well, wait a second. You know, some of the musicals you just mentioned there, okay? Mm-hmm. You've got In the Heights. You've got Book of Mormon. You got, well, Billy Elliot. Hamilton, let's just take that off the table for a second. Or really, we don't even need to talk about it. But Dear Evan Hansen, okay? Kinky Boots, all of these made their way around the country, and some made it to the West End. Others made it to Paris, Australia.
Oh, they've played the whole world. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, right. The most recent ones have not. But yeah, they're going to. But yeah, they've all played all over the world. Everybody's, you know, had a chance, you know, reasonably speaking, if you live in a major city or travel a bit, you know, it's big, wide-ranging, world-spanning hits.
So how is this bad?
To win the Tony for Best Musical?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's silly. It was a study. And the first clue that they don't know what they're talking about is they pointed out that 6 shows from the last 10 years have already closed. Like, they won the Tony for Best Music, but they've already closed, meaning a show from a decade ago is not still running. that shows an ignorance about Broadway. Shows don't run for 10 years. If you run for 2.5 years, you will be one of the 100 longest running shows in Broadway history. You know, that's a monster blockbuster. You went for 4 years. That's a home run, a grand slam home run. The idea that you're not still running 5, 8, 10 years later is a sign of weakness. That's crazy. That's just, you don't know what you're talking about. That's just dumb. So right away, you know, they don't know what they're talking about. But I thought, well, you know, I'm sure there's some years where the show wins Best Musical, but another show runs longer. And part of that is why people vote. Sometimes they think that show's such a big hit, it doesn't need any help. But this show we love and we want it to do better. Everybody has different reasons for voting. Most of the time, I think they vote for the show they think is the best. But sometimes you're a road producer and you think, that's my kind of show. I want that to win Tony and come and we'll make a lot of money. But if you go back and listen, we've got a list in our show notes to all the shows over the years. If you go back and look at them, you can see that every show that won the Tony for Best Musical was helped. Most of the time, they did better than all the other shows. And a few times where like there was a bigger hit like Wicked, so what? They still were benefited from winning Best Musical. It kept a show like A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder. That was probably the best example. You know, that was a year where Aladdin and Beautiful opened. Those shows are monster hits. They are still running. A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, however, ran 905 performances, almost 2.5 years, over 2 years, I think. And the fact that they won the Tony kept them open like twice as long as they probably would have otherwise. It gave them the name brand so that when they went on the road, they could draw an audience and say, best musical. To say that they, you know, somehow the Tony is meaningless because Aladdin is still running is silly. It just doesn't show any knowledge about, yes, the one thing you can say is winning Best Musical really, really helps. It's not going to help you 100% of the time. But if you go back year to year, look at the shows that won, look at Lost, most of the time, you're the longer running show. And even if you're not, it's clear they benefited it. So, and pointing out that a show isn't open for 8 years, that's just stupid.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Well, and as you pointed out, not many are.
No, virtually none. If you run 2.5 years, that's 1,000 performances. That's a tremendous success. Aladdin and Beautiful, which are still running, they're in like the top 50, top 40 already. You know, those are incredibly long running shows. That just doesn't usually happen. So your measure of success cannot be, are you one of the 20 longest running shows of all time? That's silly. So there you go. Well, I just couldn't let that study. It was a study at some, you know, some academic. Clearly doesn't know much about the economics or the business or why people vote the way they do on Broadway. You know, they're not voting to say which show do we think will last the longest commercially. They're voting for the show they think is best.
And we're not going to run down all of the winners because you can, of course, look them up.
Yeah, we just did. Yeah, we did. Yeah, we're done. That's it. Moving on.
Okay, well, I guess we're moving on, unfortunately, to our sexual misconduct segment. Whereas I predicted to some of the people who work at Disney Animation and Pixar, who said, no, John Lasseter is coming back. I was like, no, he's not. He's definitely not.
It's still an amazing thing. John Lasseter is exiting Disney. They got to give him some consulting fee till the end of the year, probably because it's just a good, you know, tax reason. But basically, he's out the door and he's never returning. This is a guy worth, you know, billions of dollars to Disney. You know, he has overseen franchises and films that have been extrapolated into theme parks and sequels and toys and merchandise to a remarkable amount. And there's a huge team of people who do it, and they're going to continue to do it. But he was the face and the name and the genius that they trusted. And to kick him to the door is really significant, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, once they did that with Roseanne, I guess the... you know, they kind of had to immediately do it with John Lasseter. I don't know if you noticed.
I don't think they have anything to do with each other whatsoever.
Well,
and John Lasseter has never been accused of racism or saying things that would destroy their brand and make nobody want to work with them. He just was a person who had inappropriate behavior at work, drunken, sexually harassing, constant problems. They've done it repeatedly, tried to counsel him and get him to change over the years, and it never worked. And finally, they said they'd had enough. I don't think the two issues are connected. You think the timing of it shows clearly that they just said, well, we can't bring him back after kicking her to the curb.
Well, I think, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I think it's just a matter of a corporate policy. Like, you know, is, you know, how do you kick Roseanne to the curb, okay, for her behavior and not show John Lasseter the door for his behavior? I agree with you. They are completely separate incidences and completely separate cases with different ramifications. But at the end of the day, it's one company that's doing the hiring.
Well, I think it's more about all the people who are still there working. And if they have a problem with him, are you damaging yourself by bringing him back? It shows the people who come forward and express problems with it and finally feel safe enough to say something like, I have to literally fend him off at board meetings or when we're having meetings, which is insane and ridiculous, they're not being listened to. That can really poison the well for a long time. And that's the issue CBS faces. They have just struck a new deal with an NCIS producer, even as they're investigating him again for abusive behavior. This is a person who oversees NCIS New Orleans, and people have spoken up about Brad Kern and his behavior and, you know, demeaning, sexist, racist, sexual harassment comments again and again and again. And they're like, you know, if you're going to just keep in business with this guy, you know, we don't feel safe coming forward. People are disgusted. They're really angry that CBS continues to do business with him, even though he has repeatedly created problems on set and is a poisonous presence, as far as a lot of people who work on his shows have said over the years. So they're gambling that a very viable franchise and a producer they've had commercial success with is worth more than the complaints of the people who work under him.
Well, you know, speaking of poisoning the well, okay, we have Chris Hardwick now. He is the former CEO of Nerdist, and he has a podcast as well.
And he hosts game shows for NBC, and he hosts The Talking Dead on AMC, and he is a fixture at Comic-Con, a beloved figure in the pop cultural comic book nerdy world.
Not anymore, apparently.
I wouldn't say not anymore, you know. He's been accused of abuse and sexual assault by his ex-girlfriend. She did that in a post online. As you say, some people have taken immediate action. He denies it. He says she cheated on him and they broke up. She wanted to get back together. He refused. And now we're, you know, waiting for more information. AMC has pulled the TV show Talking with Chris Hardwick, even though it's not airing at the moment, I don't believe. And he chose to step aside or was disinvited from Comic-Con, where he would have hosted panels on various TV shows because he's a big fixture there. NBC said, well, we take this seriously and we're paying attention and looking into it and, you know, waiting to see what happens and, you know, look internally. We have never had any complaints about him, but we'll certainly, you know, wait to see what goes on. I do get a little disturbed when people, the second an accusation is made, they're erasing a person from history. We must never see their shows again. We must erase their name from all books. You know,
it's well, especially creepy. Because, you know, it's like, you know, innocent until proven guilty. And I realize this is not the court of law, but this is one woman's statement. Okay. And yes, if half the things that she said in her post are true, it would be horrible. Okay, but you never know what somebody's reasoning for doing that is. And it just really disturbs me. And I say this as somebody who watched something happen at their child's school recently, where a teacher was accused of sexual assault because they pulled, it was a gym teacher, because they were fixing a kid's shirt before they went and played a game. Mm-hmm. And watched what happened to that teacher.
You want to take every complaint seriously. People don't generally run around. The vast majority of accusations of rape are in fact true.
Yes,
but some aren't, a tiny percentage. And the vast majority of rapists never go to jail. Even far bigger percentage remain free forever because it's not reported. Or if it is reported and the charges are brought, they're found innocent because you can't prove that they're guilty. Doesn't mean that they didn't do it. So we want to take it seriously. Corporations have a responsibility to act. And you want to put everything in context. You know, one woman came forward and said he has been abusive and terrible to her and also accused him of sexual assault. If other people come forward, that makes our job easier. If 10 women step forward from different points of his life, then you go, okay. Or there are a lot of people, corporations know they have a bad reputation. You know, they know they're a problem. They knew John Lasseter was a problem for years and they looked the other way. They knew Roseanne has a history of hate-filled comments and, you know, abusive behavior towards employees. You know, her set was roiled throughout the original run of Roseanne. A very abusive, difficult person to work with.
As a matter of fact, there was a New Yorker article on that very subject.
Right. This is not news. Chris Hardwick, I don't know anything about him. I've never worked with him. Maybe he has a bad reputation too. But as far as I can gather, he doesn't necessarily. None of this means what she says isn't true. But, you know, look into it. If he works for you, you want to meet with people and say, have you had any issues with him? You have any trouble? If they all say no, then you go, well, we'll hold off and see what's going on, you know? But the immediately jump and assume he's a terrible person is a little unpleasant. And that brings us to George Takei.
Yeah, now George, speaking of people who then, you know, were immediately, you know, eyebrows were raised and
He's been, you know, he was an important advocate online, an important figure in gay rights and also just internet freedom and you know, liberty and democracy and good values that most people should embrace. He's been an increasingly good figure in recent years, a nice campaigner for human rights and decency. And a man accused him of sexual assault, of drugging him and sexually assaulting him. But one journalist has finally looked into it, caught their breath, spoken to the man at length, spoken to the people around him that he had access to, spoken to experts based on the descriptions of what he says happened, looked at his pattern of how he described the behavior in the media, because it changed repeatedly in the days after he first mentioned it, and looked into it. I think his result can be summed up as saying that this guy, ultimately, they went back to George Takei's house. He had a couple drinks. George Takei made a pass at him. He said no, and then George Takei sent him home. Like, literally, that's all he said. He actually ultimately said, no, I don't think he necessarily touched my genitals. He didn't wish he hadn't made a pass in the first place, but as soon as he said, I'm not interested, George Takei stopped. That seems to be the sum total of it. But because of how he did it and how he said it and the claim of drugging him, which doesn't hold up when you look at the thing. He also claimed he told a boyfriend at the time and his female fiance at the time that George Takei had assaulted him. And neither of them said that was true. They're like, I don't remember that. And you'd probably remember it. So what we have is this guy wasn't lying. They went to his house. He made a pass at him. And, you know, he felt it was unpleasant. He wished it hadn't happened. And he wished George Takei would apologize. But he conflated that into years later saying, maybe he raped me. Maybe he drugged me. And he went public with it many years later, and it doesn't seem quite fair because all that really happened was that he made a pass and he said no.
Right. How many people will cover that?
Well, you know, it was covered in the Observer in a UK paper, and hopefully they will. But it's very hard to rehabilitate your name. But that doesn't mean anyone who has actually been assaulted or believes they've been treated poorly shouldn't speak up. But it just means, you know, catch your breath. George Takei had an impeccable track record. He was known as a good person. Nobody had ever accused him of anything like this before. Nobody came forward afterwards to say, oh, yeah, that happened to me too. And so slowly the evidence accumulates. And when this guy is spoken to at length and you say, well, now what's, you know, describe exactly. So it's heartbreaking. You never want to say, don't come out. You won't be believed. You want to hear people, you want to listen to them, but you also don't want to destroy people's lives just because of an immediate, you don't need 10 people to come forward. One accusation with evidence or validity, you know, is enough to act.
Right. But, and I don't know where in the Chris Hardwick situation, you get the evidence.
Well, you know, did she tell others at the time, have other people coming forward, that sort of thing. It's difficult. You're also talking about a private life versus behavior on the set or at work.
Right. Correct.
So I think obviously companies should be, hey, anybody had any, they got to make sure people feel comfortable coming forward. He's a big name. You know, he doesn't seem like a big, big name, but he's a big name. He's got a little industry there. He's heading game shows. He's heading talk shows. He's making people a lot of money and he's the powerful guy on the set there. Does everyone feel comfortable bringing complaints forward? You want to double check and triple check and make sure. That should always be the case. But, you know, it's ugly. It's not easy. Most people who are mistreated or assaulted or abused or raped do not get any recompense, do not get any justice. They're the ones you care the most about. But you also want to make sure you don't just leap to conclusions unnecessarily. Yeah, you know, and I've got a link to that George Takei article. It really is interesting. The person was not there to hang the poor guy who just sounded like a fan, you know. The relationship with Takei, he sort of met him a couple times, meant a lot more to this guy than it did to George Takei, which happens a lot when you're a celebrity. People are like, I know George Takei. Yeah, not really. George Takei was like, I really don't remember this guy. You know, so it's a thoughtful, interesting article. It's not there to paint the guy as hateful or evil. It's complex. Takei didn't actually speak to them, but it's worth a read, I think.
Well, it seems to me that, you know, to the guy, meeting George Takei was a big deal.
Yes.
But George Takei didn't think so.
Should have him on the show.
Right. Well, that does mean it. It's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, the Producers Guild has new heads and they are both women. For the first time in history, the PGA will be led by women, specifically Gail Berman and Lucy Fisher. Berman is currently the head of the Jackal Group, which has all sorts of projects running from an animated film based on the Addams Family, TV shows on Netflix and Fox and AMC and ABC, as well as a Broadway musical based on the Bette Midler film The Rose. Previously, she worked at Paramount, Fox Network, and Sandollar, which is where I know her from, where she executive produced Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Fisher is the co-head of Red Wagon, working on projects like the Divergent series and The Great Gatsby. She's one of the most respected producers in the business. Previously, she has been at Sony, Warner Brothers, and began at Francis Ford Coppola's Zoetrope. Both have served in various capacities at the PGA and ran unopposed. Big Deal or Big Whoop?
I think it's a big deal. It's a great thing. And we listed their credits to say, don't get any silly idea like, well, they just chose women. It's like, no. These are substantial people with a lot of work behind them. And they're valid, good heads of the PGA. And we're glad to see it. A nice counterpoint to what we were saying during the sexual harassment section.
Yeah, no, Lucy Fisher, everybody loves. I mean, she is a very well-respected producer.
And Gail Berman is connected to Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Nothing could be more good positive credentials to me than that. That's one of my favorite TV shows of all time.
Vive la France! Vive le Salto! That's the rallying cry French TV groups hope to stir in Francophiles with the launch of a new streaming service dubbed Salto. It's equally owned by public broadcaster France Televisions and the privately owned M6 and TF1.
Surely it would be France Television.
Correct. Now, Salto will offer news, specials, French and U.S. TV shows, documentaries, films, and exclusive content. No word on its budget, how much original content it will offer, what shows will be included, and so on. But let's just call it the French Hulu and, just be done with it. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. It's what people need to do. They're all setting up, some streaming service, whether it turns out to be a good idea, whether they create compelling original content or have such a rich library that it works. I don't know. The silly thing is to say they're taking on Netflix and Amazon. No, they're not. They're just trying to set up their own business. Not every streaming service is taking on Netflix. They don't have $8 billion, so they're just trying to make something that's appealing and successful because they realize not everyone is going to buy a cable package in the future.
The Dave Matthews Band showed rock still has a little life left in it. The act's new album debuted at number one and sold. Yes, sold, okay? 285,000 actual copies of the album dubbed Come Tomorrow. It's their seventh studio album in a row to debut at number one, a record for groups, and it's the biggest sales week for a rock album in 4 years. That streak of number one studio albums for Dave Matthews Band began 20 years ago with 1998's Before These Crowded Streets. That's absolutely astounding to me, and it feels like that album was
yesterday.
Before 1998, but I could be wrong. Big deal or big whoop?
You're old. The last rock album to do really good was Coldplay with Ghost Stories. And here what we're looking at with these big sales, this is another concert ticket album hybrid. It's not that they give away the album necessarily, but if you're going to buy a ticket to Dave Matthews, you pay a little extra and then you get a copy of their album. I'm not sure what the cost was, $10, $8, $15, I don't know, but it's a package deal. You buy a ticket, get the album, pay a little extra, that sort of thing. And that's what a lot of people are doing. It's valid. They want to see you live. You get them to pay a little extra and get your album as well. It counts. Taylor Swift did it with 1.2 million copies. That was with Reputation a little while ago. But it's very impressive no matter how you get them to do it. You get them to buy a concert ticket. That's great. Get them to buy an album as well. Even better.
There's more action on the singles chart. K-pop boy band BTS continues to make waves. Just after hitting the top 10 with their latest single, and while briefly hitting number one on the album charts, BTS was featured in a what is it? A U.S. network TV ad, actually, for the LG smartphone. Now, that's a sign of making it.
I was I was like, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. Well, while they were making history for Korean acts, actor and hip-hop artist Chris Wu was making history for Chinese artists. He's apparently the first person born in China to hit the U.S. Hot 100 singles chart. Wu did it with the song Like That, which peaked at, number 73, and even hit the top 40 on the R&B charts. Wu says he wants to be the Jackie Chan of music, but he's also a threat in movies. Wu has had major supporting roles in some U.S. films like XXX The Return of Xander Cage and starred in Chinese smash hits like Journey to the West, The Demons Strike Back. Wu spent his teen years in Canada, but Korea can claim him too. Wu's big break was being named the 11th member of K-pop boy band EXO, or is it EXO? I never know. Big deal or big whoop?
Brings it all back to Korea, doesn't it? I think it's a big deal. It's very cool. You get to be the first, the first Chinese-born person to chart on the U.S. album singles chart. Beg your pardon. That's very cool. It's great news. It's what makes America great. Diversity, immigrants. Anyway.
Yes, we will separate you at the border.
Thank you.
Harry Potter fan festivals have been popping up all over the country, and Warner Brothers is really, they're not happy about it at all. Ithaca, New York is typical. Their event started in an alleyway, as, it should, in 2015, and in just 2 years attracted some 20,000 fans.
It was a Diagon alleyway, but keep going.
Yes. Chestnut Hill College near Philly hosts a Quidditch tournament that coincides with a suburban Potter festival that drew 45,000 fans to the event in 2017. All of them tend to be non-profit and fan-guided events filled with costumes and sorting hat events and the like. Like staged readings of the Harry Potter play, they're innocent good fun, but play havoc with copyright that Warner Brothers and J.K. Rowling must defend to keep more nefarious folk from abusing the brand. Big deal or big whoop?
I guess it's a big whoop in general, but I know it's difficult, but I feel like lawyers just like to say no. The easiest thing is to say no. Tell them they can't. They can't. They can't. They can't. There has to be something smarter to do when you've got tens of thousands of people spontaneously celebrating your brand. There's got to be something they can do that makes it slightly approved and nonprofit and maybe benefiting charity, but it doesn't make you culpable for whatever they do. There's just got to be something smarter to do here. You've got 45,000 people showing up for a Harry Potter festival. This is not something you should be, stomping down. You've got to figure out something smarter than just don't do it.
I get it that if you're Warner Brothers, you don't want to say, okay, we'll give you the nonprofit license. Hypothetically naming it. Because then all of a sudden you realize, well, it's nonprofit because you're paying yourself $15 million. Okay.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's not easy, but there has to be something smarter that they can do. At the very least, they've got a huge untapped demand. And when it's fan guided, there's got to be, I don't know, but this isn't the answer. It's not smart. We will rock you. I'm sorry, is that not right?
Well, okay, you must be moving on to our next story, which was a big hit at Cine Europe. I don't know whether they showed the whole film. I know that they showed the whole film of A Star Is Born, which people really liked. Actually, when you're showing a movie months in advance, the studio showing a movie that far in advance, they have a lot of confidence in it. What's his name? Brad, what's his face? Why am I? Bradley Cooper. Yeah. Wow. Talk about a senior moment there. And Lady Gaga, that's the remake of A Star Is Born, and it's looking to do quite well. Well,
and they did the same with Bohemian Rhapsody. They showed footage from it or a big chunk of it, or you're not sure anymore?
I'm not sure, because of course the people who saw it were like sworn to secrecy, but they did take a whole bunch of film buyers out to see Queen perform with Adam Lambert.
Very fun.
And then they brought out, Roger Taylor and Brian May when they introduced the film, along with Rami Malek, who plays Freddie Mercury. Now, the reason I mention all of this is because director Bryan Singer was fired from his job directing the Queen rock band biopic Bohemian Rhapsody, and not showing up will, when you don't show up to work, that'll happen. However, it won't stop you from getting final credit as the sole director of the film. You might recall we talked about all this. Now, Dexter Fletcher stepped in to finish the film and presumably oversee editing, but Singer is the director of record. Up next, a fun debate over who does the press tour and how they convince journalists not to ask Singer pesky questions about not showing up, and is his gravely ill parent, and that's said in quotes, better, and was it his father or his mother, and why does he have a history of disappearing from big movies, and why aren't there more scenes of Freddie Mercury being super gay because his band's name, after all, was Queen, and is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I guess it's a big whoop. The director that came in was Dexter Fletcher, and he shot for 16 days. I assume perhaps he oversaw the editing as well. I don't know if Bryan Singer came back into it. I assume not. He was fired, actually, so he didn't. But 16 days isn't going to get you the director credit on the film. But this is just the beginning of their problems with this movie, not the end. If it's a good movie, nobody will care. But for Bryan Singer and his future history, it should be problematic and should be something that he's concerned about. I looked it up, and it looks like Fox gave an extended look at Bohemian Rhapsody. So they didn't screen the entire film, at least according to the Deadline Hollywood report. They showed a good chunk of it.
Yeah, you know what's interesting to me, okay, about Cine Europe is beforehand, the day that the event starts, they sit all of the journalists covering the event down, and they tell us we can't write about the studio presentations. We're just not allowed to do it.
Don't even think of it.
Right. Period. End of story. You don't tweet it. You don't Facebook it. You don't Instagram
and
it.
And if you want to know why, quote Romans 1:13. Anyway, never mind. Sorry.
But then you have Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, Deadline. They all do it anyway. You know, if we were to do that at Celluloid Junkie, we'd be, you know, run up a flagpole.
That's right.
But then we don't cover that kind of stuff, so...
It doesn't matter. So, you know, I sat next to Brian May at the theater, went to see the all-male Swan Lake, directed by Matthew Bourne. And Brian was there with his wife, who's a big soap star in the UK. And people kept coming up to her for autographs, kept coming up to him for autographs. And we were watching this show, and he said, oh, Freddie would have loved this. My little Brian May story. But anyway.
Now, Marvel Comics legend Stan Lee could use his own superhero right now. The 95-year-old Titan has never been more popular or more profitable. Unfortunately, age has left him vulnerable, and everyone from family to friends to his business manager, they're all trading charges of elder abuse and things like that. One week, Lee releases a video insisting his business manager is the only person who represents his interests. The next, that some business manager is arrested on suspicious, you know, I guess they arrested him because they thought he filed a false police report. And Lee, or someone representing him, asks for a restraining order against the man. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I guess it's a big whoop in the scheme of things. You rarely have people this wealthy reaching this age and being this vulnerable to the depredations of others. Clearly, someone is taking advantage of him, whether it's the business manager or the other people involved. It's just very sad and unpleasant to see.
Well, that was quick. Last episode, we said there was still a difference between streaming services and record labels. This episode, we can report Spotify is reaching out directly to artists and managers. License your tracks directly to us, and you'll get almost the same royalty rate as record labels do, about 50% of revenue. Contracts vary wildly, but many small acts might get 20% of the take record labels bring in. So getting 100% of that money means their take would increase 500%. Now that's a lot of numbers, but in short, they'd be cutting out the middleman. Is Spotify becoming a record label? No more than Amazon is using their platform to become a publisher. Self-published authors can use that platform to make their books available and still own their own copyright. Now Spotify is looking to do the same. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop at the moment because they have contracts with major labels that say they can't compete directly in meaningful ways with them. They're getting very close to this. So I think we're going to be seeing this tested in court sometime soon. If they start to keep signing up more and more people and trying to do this, right now, maybe it's just seen as a little less not that active, or they're not going to be reaching the sort of people that labels will care about. But they're skirting the edge of what they're allowed to do. And I don't know how much longer it can last.
Throwing other record labels into conniptions, Sony has announced plans to dole out money from the sale of its stake in Spotify and give it, get this, to the artists and record labels they oversee. The payments will begin as early as August, and Sony promises not to use the money simply to cover artists' debt like studio time or advances. The artists and the record labels, they get the money for free and clear. How much, of course, depends on a complicated formula, all of which was devised by Sony. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal, especially if others feel pressured to follow their lead. Of course, it all depends on the largesse of Sony, and that's not acceptable. You know, this, you know, you're making money off your artists, whether it's an investment in another company that you're given a piece of. They should get a piece of that anyway, and it should be overseen, and accounting should be in there, not something that they give you like, oh, I'm a generous person. Nonetheless, they didn't have to do it. It's better than not doing it, so it's a good step forward.
The iconic Miss America beauty pageant is no longer a pageant, and it's not about beauty, which is why,
maybe
by the way,
enter.
I was going to say this is going to be my first year trying to enter.
I'm sorry, I stepped on your joke. That was a good joke.
After a scandal of insulting treatment of women and other discordant attitudes in a quote hashtag Me Too era, the seemingly archaic event is determined to make itself meaningful in the 21st century. I almost said it was getting a makeover, but that would be sexist and heterosexual white male of me, and we're trying to get away from that sort of thing. Gretchen Carlson is the first winner to be named head of Miss America's Board of Trustees, and that board is now composed entirely, get this, of women. They're ditching the bathing suit section, making it,
Get rid of it. It's gone. They're not making it anything. It's gone.
Right. So, like, literally every straight man is like, "What? Why would I watch it then?" They're going to emphasize the competition aspect and say women will be judged on their talent, passion, and smarts. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop because I don't think it has the weight that it had decades ago. If you did this change 30 years ago, that would be more empowering and interesting. But it's still around. It airs September 9th on ABC. And if you're saying men only care about women if they're in a bathing suit, you're part of the problem. You're like, it was a joke. It was a simple joke.
He's stealing my lines now. Yes, it was a simple joke. Although not so simple. And depending on whether you laughed or not, maybe
revealing,
even not a joke.
Revealing. Much like the bathing suits they used to have to wear.
Exactly. Now, Oprah. You see how I did it like Dave Letterman?
I do indeed.
Oprah. Okay.
Got it.
Well, yes, the two titans of industry are now business partners, with Oprah signing a content deal with Apple. Oprah agreed to a non-exclusive deal. After all, let's face it, she does have her own cable channel. And Oprah didn't include podcasts because she already has a platform for that. Otherwise, everything is on the table. Movies, TV shows, apps, books, and you name it. Oprah can appear on air on a limited basis per her agreement with the cable channel own Oprah Winfrey Network. So this is more about Oprah as a producer. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's a good get for Apple. She's created a lot of content that's proved popular. She's a great name to draw people in. She's going to own her own content that she creates for Apple, which is a different than the deals that Netflix is doing with people where they want to own the content those people create for them. So that may be one reason Apple went out and in seizing Oprah, because I'm sure Amazon and Netflix were interested as well. But, you know, she appears on 60 Minutes. She's got stuff on HBO. She's got a lot of stuff going on. This is another big deal for Oprah, and no surprise that she's in the thick of it when it comes to streaming video.
And you get a podcast, and you get a podcast.
She should get our podcast.
Exactly. Now, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, let's face it, we have to talk about only one piece of news, and that is, after all the hoopla starting in 2016 of AT&T trying to buy Time Warner, the Justice Department then coming out in 2017 and saying, we're going to sue you for antitrust. And then the actual trial earlier this year, the 6-week trial. June 12th, the judge came down and said, no, AT&T and Time Warner can merge.
To be clear, the judge said, of course they can merge. I mean, it wasn't just an approval. It was an approval with a parade and some cake.
Yes, you know, it was absolutely remarkable, that ruling.
Yeah, it was a an extensive, complex, you know, involved wound that he knew the weight of it. He took his time and care. It was incredibly detailed. He took into account all sorts of different issues, but he said, by God, of course they can merge. Not only can they merge, he gave green lights to Comcast to go after other big properties.
Well, did he actually say, I have not had a chance to read the 500-page ruling.
In the way it was worded and the things he said, that he set this up not only for this particular merger, but in general. And so basically it was indeed a green light for Comcast and others to merge. And he also said, if you try, the government should not try and stall this merge and keep it from happening when they could not succeed judicially. They have lost in the courts. He believes they have no grounds for appeal. And he said what they should avoid doing is trying to put more roadblocks in the way to keep this from happening, even though they will not succeed in the courts as he sees it. So it was as green a light as you can get.
And of course, days later, they finalized the merger.
Yes, and Time Warner will now be called Warner Media. And the Fox board is now meeting on Wednesday to consider Comcast's new offer. It's now been up to $65 billion in an all-cash offer. And Sperling's cable bill has increased 46%.
That is correct.
Yes, and that's one of the issues that, you know, we can't offer a lot on this other than, yeah, this is a big impact. This is really going to impact everyone. But two things struck me. One was, the essential argument, as I understand it, is, hey, it's a new world. You're going to compete with Amazon and Google and Apple. What are you going to do? And Netflix? You got to be bigger. He's like, how can they compete against those guys unless they're bigger? We would say, well, maybe those guys shouldn't be so big.
I would say is, you know who was going to get really big and everybody was really afraid of, and oh my gosh, all the studios were shaking. They're going to get so big. We don't know what to do. DreamWorks.
Yeah. And the other thing is that, as I think one commentator in Billboard put it, and we've got links to a lot of stories in our show notes, so you can find all of this there, their analysis, it seemed like he spent a lot of time and effort trying to figure out if your cable bill would go up 46 cents a month.
Well, that's, you know, really the answer to that is, yeah, you're right, he did, because that was one of the big things that the Justice Department kind of pointed out.
That's also been a judicial and conservative philosophy for decades. You look at a merger and all you do is say, will prices increase? If they won't, then you should let it go, as if that's the only thing that matters. And this person said, that is not only is that not the only lens you should use, but since that's so hard to determine in advance and it's so difficult, it probably shouldn't even be the primary lens that you use. When you look at a company getting this big, you know, now that AT&T and Time Warner are merging, guess what? Netflix, you better become an ISP. You better get bigger. You know, you're going to be in trouble if you have to depend on others to be the internet service provider, right? You know, that everybody else has got to get bigger. And if those got to get bigger, then the people below them got to get bigger. And everybody's got to keep getting bigger. There's a lot more to look at than just, you know, price, especially in the short term. Is it good for the economy? Is it good for business? Is it good for jobs? Is it good for the culture and the political atmosphere of the country? Do you want three companies having all the jobs? It's like, bigger is not necessarily better.
That is true.
Yeah, so it's big, it's ugly. And at the same time, the UK has cleared Fox's bid for Sky, assuming that they sell. You know, they can get Sky and then they can sell it. And they also approved the Comcast bid as well. So Comcast has got a chance at that. You know, you were thinking, you can't necessarily take the Comcast bid because they won't get regulatory approval. Well, guess what they just got? A big fat green light that says, of course, you'll get regulatory approval. Not a given.
Well, no, I didn't. Did I say that about Comcast?
Yeah, that one reason they might reject the Comcast bid is because it might not go through. Because of concerns about Comcast picking up Fox.
Oh, okay. Fox. Yeah, no, okay. I thought you meant the Sky. I got completely confused there. Yeah. I thought you were saying that the Sky, that the UK government would turn it down because, yeah, no. As far as Fox and you know, taking the Comcast bid versus the Disney bid, you're absolutely correct. I did say I don't think that they would take the Comcast bid because it has such a low chance of getting through. That was yesterday. Now, I would say all bets are off and it would definitely go through.
Yeah. So it's a huge impact. It's changing the landscape even as we speak. My goodness.
Yeah. And not necessarily in a good way, but time will tell.
Nope.
Now, Time also told us that unfortunately, we have two obituaries. Kate Spade, of course, committed suicide. And so did Anthony Bourdain. In fact, just before I got on the plane, I downloaded Kitchen Confidential. And I said, you know, I'm going to reread this book. And I was...
Reread it.
Yes. And I was reading it and I thought, God, this guy's living the life. You know, he gets to travel all over the place and he's a, you know, good chef and he's writing cookbooks. And I turn on my phone and the first notification to come up was about Anthony Bourdain.
What's a very popular book. And I had a friend, Sam, who got it as a gift at Christmas time. And picked it up literally like a week before he died and said, I'm going to read this, and was starting to read it and loving it. So it is a great book. It's worth picking up. It's very sad. I think we're learning a little bit more about the best way for media to cover people's deaths. I'm seeing more and more outlets be a little more responsible. You don't talk about them committing suicide in the headline, and you don't describe the way they died. They did that for Anthony Bourdain. They certainly did not do that for Kate Spade, where they described in detail how she killed herself. Very sad in both cases. Just emphasizes how suicide is a national crisis. It's risen 25 to 30% in the last 30 years. Some of that is due to the Great Recession and white middle-aged men who saw their career prospects collapse. But it's broader than that, and it's across, gender, and it's across race and ethnicity, and across wealth and lack of wealth. So it's a serious problem, and I think we're learning better about how to talk about it and how to cover it. And hopefully we'll keep doing that ourselves. And I think best of all is that we talk about it, not in the sense of glorifying in the particular details or say, how could someone that successful kill themselves? We know perfectly well that having success commercially does not mean you're going to have a happy or easy life. I think that that should be clear to anyone by now when you wonder, how could Anthony Bourdain kill himself? You know, the more people talk about it, the better it is, because if you're worried about somebody and thinking they may be really unhappy and you're concerned about them, sometimes people think, well, I don't want to say anything because that might push them over the edge. No, showing concern and empathy and care is never going to be a trigger event to make someone harm themselves. If you're showing concern and care, that is only a good. So don't be afraid to raise the issue with people. Don't be afraid to talk about depression if you are dealing with it, because it's a chronic issue you'll deal with your whole life. And the more people know about it, the more comfort and support you'll get.
Yeah, I mean, Kanye West released an album over the weekend. And it was...
He has two albums out in the last 2 weeks.
Well, okay. And he, you know, what is the name of the title? Is
One album is Ye, and the other one is with the Kid Cudi.
Well, the Ye one, the cover says, I hate, what is it? The cover was, I hate bipolar disorder. It's awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
it was showing about the conflicts and the contradictory feelings you have about, you know, your mental health. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's being very open and honest about it. And I have to commend him for that.
Yeah. And hopefully he's getting the help he needs and not plunging back into a whirlwind of work, because he had a meltdown last time. And I hope he's not overextending himself. But people around him will know better than us. People also know Bond girls, don't they?
They
do. A little
do.
Happier news. The first Bond girl, Eunice Grayson, died at 90. She is the only actress to appear in two Bond films in the role of a Bond girl. We've obviously had M and other characters and Miss Moneypenny repeat as a female actors. It's a once awesome tradition, the Bond girl, and became sort of embarrassing and quaint. Then it became sort of cool again. They rehabilitated it, let them be, you know, empowered women who were played important roles and didn't just stand around waiting to have sex with Bond. But, you know, they become smart, active, capable, and yet still attractive. You know, so it began with Dr. No. That's where she was in. And as Hollywood Reporter pointed out, she offered the setup line to the classic Bond dialogue. In a scene at the Le Cercle Club, her character met Sean Connery over a game of cards. After she suggested they raise the stakes, Bond said, I admire your courage, miss. To which she said, Trench, Sylvia Trench, I admire your luck, mister. Bond, James Bond. So in a way, she sort of said it first, Trench, Sylvia Trench. So full credit to the first Bond girl, and we know there'll be many, many more to come.
Kind of like our show, there'll be many, many more to come.
That's true.
But this week's show is coming to an end.
Aww.
And remember, if you don't want to miss any of those shows, you can subscribe to us in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, Google Play Store. You can find our show, you can rate and review it, you can subscribe to it, and it really does help us out when you do. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as those ways to subscribe to us, can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's DIRT@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter at ShowbizSandbox is our handle, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. And of course, all of that information, once again, is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's Giltz, michaelgiltz.com. I've switched it up.
Okay, well, actually, part of that website is actually a way to reach some of your work, which is all aggregated on michaelgiltz.com. So if you want to read some of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry, go to michaelgiltz.com. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com to know what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.